I'm David John Douglas. I'm a lifelong coal miner from 8 generations of coal miners. I started off work in the Durham coal field, as did my dad and my granddad. Family had originally come down from Northumberland. During the Wilson closure programme, I was transferred along with tens of thousands of other miners from Northumberland, Durham and Scotland into South Yorkshire and Nottingham. And I worked for 30 years as a tunneller at Hatfield Main Colliery in Doncaster. I also became a branch official of the National Union of Mine Workers for 25 years and served on the Executive Area Council with various posts on the National Executive.
Now, I mean, coal mining is something that is probably still a bit better known in the north than it is in the south. But can you just break down some of the basic jobs that there were? Because not all miners were doing the same thing, were they, David?
No, I mean, you can only go forward. It's like a battlefield. You can only be at the front if there's enough people behind you to supply you and to, facilitate that movement. So the production workers are the sort of top of the tree. The people who drive the tunnels, heading men, as they call them in Yorkshire, heat men, or canch men, as we call them in the north. They drive the tunnels forward into the new coal reserves. And the coal face workers, the hewers, or the colliers, as they call them in Yorkshire, extract the coal. Behind them, we have the supply workers, the haulage lads, the people who bring the material forward to support the new exposed areas and also transport the coal away from the face, either on belts or in the olden days in tubs and mine cars. And behind them, of course, in the pit bottom, you've got to get all of that coal out of the mine and all of the materials that you need in. And then the men on the surface. Men on the surface are usually the lowest paid workers, often workers who've worked at the front and been injured or become old. And their job is to process the coal, wash the coal, make sure it's ready for sale.
Now, you say that you've spent a lifetime in the business, but really it was surely pretty much hammered in the 1980s. There wasn't a lot of mining left after the Thatcher era and the big battles with your union.
Well, you would think that, but if that was the case, we'd still be here, really, because it was the Thatcher's plan was not to wipe out the British coal industry. Thatcher's plan was to wipe out the National Union of Mine Workers. And she hoped she'd be able to do that. She hoped she'd be able to fillet the nationalized mine industry to make it ready for selling off to private coal owners. I mean, actually, there were no unprofitable mines in Britain in a world comparison. But if you compared one mine to another mine in Britain, then obviously some were more profitable than others. So her intention was to get rid of the third of the mines, which weren't making consistent profits, and leave a super base, two-thirds of the industry left to sell to private owners. This was all dependent on being able to smash the National Union of Mine Workers. Now, a year after that strike, and with the birth of a SCAB union, which also helped to the idea of breaking the miners' union, in 1986, after we'd lost a third of the industry, maybe 50,000 men had gone, 50 mines had gone, we had a national strike ballot in 1986, 1 year after the biggest defeat of an industrial union in the history of the island and probably the world. And we voted 74% in favour of national strike action 1 year after the defeat in 1985. And this caused the coal board to withdraw its new disciplinary code, which it was trying to bring in, which was basically an anti-union set of regulations. Now, that demonstrated to somebody down in Whitehall that you can't have coal mines without miners' unions. You're never going to be able to get this leopard to change its spots. And that caused John Major to come back in 1992, 93, with his final solution to the mining industry problems, which was to get rid of it. So we still had a thriving industry, maybe 50, 60,000 miners in 50 or 60 mines in 1992. At the end of that, we were down to dozens of mines.
Now, a lot of people know the conditions were pretty awful, David. I mean, a lot of miners surely were rather relieved to be retiring from that back-breaking work. And actually dangerous work.
No, otherwise we wouldn't have fought for 12 months to stop them closing them. I mean, you know, it amuses me in a way because, you know, we are miners. You know, that's what we did. That was the job. You signed up for that. You knew what it was. You didn't want to get killed. You didn't want to get injured. So the point was to do it as safely as possible. And British mines were the safest deep mine coal mines in the world, bar none. There was no comparison with any other mining industry in the world in terms of our health and safety record, with the possible exception of Australia. But Australian mining was mainly on the surface in huge quarries in the daylight. So they weren't working in the dark or in restricted places like we were. But we were the safest coal mining industry in the world. Now, it's true that after privatization, the safety standards started to fall because our vigilance got less and people were desperate to stay in the job and not complain. But that was to do with the circumstances of the ownership and the management, not mining itself. It's not mining that's dangerous. It's the methods you use.
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, if you speak to some of the remaining Welsh miners who actually staff the Big Pit Museum in South Wales, you get both sides. You get some people saying that you know, our forefathers had worked for generations to get the good conditions that we had by the 1980s and the 90s. And we were absolutely heartbroken that the production then went abroad, where there was, very, very slack, very little unionization and actually absolutely very dangerous conditions. So anyway, we're seeing now, aren't we, another, I suppose, attack on coal. So that imported coal, even, we're being told that that is a terrible thing and that it's creating the extinction of the planet now. And so all of these coal-fired power stations have to be closed down. I would just note that one of the main campaigners who was providing the transport and the energy to close those down back in the early noughties was a guy called Mark Kennedy, who turned out actually to be a police officer, undercover police officer. But anyway, what do you make of this latest move, David, saying effectively that coal should be no more, effectively that this is a terribly dangerous thing and that it's one of the most horrific things on the planet? Coal, if we're burning it, then actually what we're doing is we're basically committing suicide.
Well, I mean, that's a hell of a long question and a big question. But the basic facts that you have to realise are these. One, coal production is expanding all over the world. Coal consumption is expanding all over the world. Coal is now more than half of all of the world's energy source, right? Now, why would anybody do that willingly? Why would somebody deliberately commit suicide and do these industries? And that's because if you look at any yardstick of health and hygiene, education, water supply, electrification, education, life expectancy, child life expectancy, that goes up on a steep line along with coal production. And that's not just a statistical quirk. It's the fact that places like China and India and Indochina, their progress into the 21st century is based on having electricity, and their electricity is based on the cheapest source of available power that there is, and that's coal power. And that's the reason why coal production is expanding in the world. It's not expanding in Britain because of a political decision which was made to kill the miners' union. It had nothing whatever to do with the rights and wrongs. The energy shortage that we're facing today has nothing really to do with the war in Ukraine. It had to do with the class war in Britain. Coal supplied 80% of the power grid. Now, we wouldn't be having energy shortages now if coal mines were still working and supplying 80% of the grid. For a start, we wouldn't be using 40% of our scarce, 40% of the energy which we produce comes from very scarce natural gas reserves. Now, those natural gas reserves were never intended to be used burning in coal and in power stations, which incidentally they produce CO2 as well. That was largely for domestic use. It was for cooking your dinner on a Sunday or, you know, for people's gas boilers. It was never intended to burn in massive gas power stations. So that's the reason why there's a shortage of it. That's why it's so expensive. And that's why we've got an energy shortage. So you pay your money, you take your choice. What do you want? Do you want old people to die of hypothermia in the winter? Do you want us to be held to ransom by other countries in the world, whether that was the Middle East during the oil crisis in the 50s and 60s, or through Russia and other countries who supply us with the gas? Or do we want to have our own indigenous natural supply? Now, if the answer is yes, do we have to produce emissions? No, we don't. We've known for half a century how to burn coal without producing CO2. We had that in the can. Thatcher pulled the plug on it. And then after that, Cameron's successor, he could see after the big rundown in 92, 93, we were developing the cleanest energy generating system in the world at Hatfield Main Colliery. It was called Green Power, the Don Valley Energy Program. And it would have produced the first hydrogenization coal-produced coal, which meant you produced the coal power, but none of the emissions, no CO2 emissions, whatever, and would take out 90% of all other emissions.
This is the stuff I think you're talking about, carbon capture, aren't you? Take us through a little bit about how that works, because it almost sounds unbelievable, doesn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it's an old idea, but the thing about it is what you do is you basically take the CO2 out of the coal, and you, through a process of hydrogenization, and this allows us to extract the energy from the coal without letting the CO2 go into the atmosphere. The CO2 is captured before the point of the energy is produced and is sent underground. So we made the old oil gas wells in the North Sea, which of course are huge caverns from which we've been taking gas since the 1940s, are empty and perfectly sealed. We can pump the CO2 into them. There's enough capacity in the oil wells alone to take all of the CO2 for the next 100 years from the whole of Europe if we wanted to, and keep it safely there. That's without the gas wells, which we could also use. So this was the first one of those processes. It was developed by Richard Budge, who was a terrible anti-union entrepreneur, but was a visionary in terms of energy. So the EU, in the days we were in the EU, and the Energy Steel Corporation, or whatever we called ourselves then, the Coal and Steel Consortium, they called it the greatest carbon reduction scheme in the world. Imagine if you applied that system in China or in India or in the United States. You would end the whole problem of CO2 in the atmosphere. And it would take you maybe 3 years to build that infrastructure. So within 3 years, you could virtually eliminate coal CO2 emissions into the atmosphere. All right? So you were sitting on really the answer to the whole problem. The problem for the Tories was, it would mean that that power station was producing the cheapest emission-free power in the world. And it would be manned by 100% union miners. With that as a choice, they pulled the plug on it.
Oh, well, it's absolutely disgusting, isn't it? Look, one of the rumours I've heard, and I'm not sure, maybe you can help me with this, is that many of the pits, when they were closed, were actually filled up with rubbish and junk in order to stop them being used again, which sounds to me like a kind of vandalism. Is there any truth to that?
Well, what they did was they filled the shafts up. See, what we did before, I mean, out my pit, Hatfield Main, which is the last pit I worked at, had four different owners. It closed four times.
Sorry, can you just name the place?
Hatfield Main Colliery in Doncaster. That was the last pit I worked at. It closed in 2015, was the second last coal mine to close in Britain. It has at least 1,000 years of reserves of coal. Now, that pit, when it was closed the second time, was closed. We didn't fill the shafts up. They only tin canned them, which was to put two copper lids over the top of the shafts to stop people falling down them. But they didn't fill the shafts. Now, the shafts within a month were full of water, so the pit was entirely flooded. Now, people had said you could never reopen a coal mine, and if we did, we wouldn't be able to work it. When the mine was reopened, it actually took them just 3 months to pump the water clear and restart the process. So you can do that. So what they then did was, when they closed the mine, they filled the shafts up with rubble. Not the whole pit, just the shafts. So you can get back into them. I mean, we nowadays, because of the cost, a shaft costs an awful lot of money to build. The modern way to do this is to make drifts. So you make a steady drift from the surface on a gradient, like we did at Selby, where you have a major drift that goes into the mine. There's no headgear. There's no pit tips or anything like that. And Selby, of course, was the most profitable coal field in Europe. And they left 100 million tons of coal in it. It only opened in 1982.
I mean, you're talking there about the closure program. Am I right in thinking that there are no working coal mines in Britain now?
Well, there's one. The one that bloody Extinction Rebellion decided to invade 2 months ago. And they ran amok wearing radiation suits. For some reason, they think there's radiation in coal mines. Carrying burning flares. Yeah,
or maybe they're working for the nuclear industry.
Well, yes. Well, we had long opposed nuclear energy in support of coal, but then we began to see that we were both threatened species at that time, and then they became desirable and we became undesirable. So, you know, nuclear energy can never be the major supplier of power in Britain. It's too intermittent. It's too independable. I mean, even France has restarted opening coal mines and coal power stations, and they depend almost entirely on nuclear. But that's beside the point. They ran amok with bloody burning flares in areas of mine that are prone to bloody heavy gas concentrations. It just tells you how thick these people are. And they outnumber the people at the pit. There's only 100 men work there. It's called Aberdare, I think they call the pit.
Right. So there is at least still one opening. And I know
there
in Cumbria.
Only one. And there are about 4 open cast mines, quarries, you know.
Yeah, so, I mean, in Cumbria, we've just got one which has just this week been given the go-ahead. But I wonder,
I've campaigned for 4 years for that mine.
Well, I mean, I wonder how long it's going to last, because if a Labour government gets in, I'm sure they'll do exactly what the Labour government under Jacinda did in New Zealand, which is to shut all fossil fuel plants. But anyway, can you just tell us a bit about how that came about and how you managed to get this victory, I suppose, which is getting this coal mine open?
Well, something that the Greens, one and all, don't understand is that you can't have wind turbines without steel. And that steel needs coal. So you can't have wind. I mean, they turned up to protest about this mine, Whitehaven, which intends to produce coke to make steel to make the turbines. And they turned up with pictures of turbines as alternatives to the coal mine, because they think wind turbines are made out of chocolate or toffee or something. You know, they have no idea where the whole thing comes from. So we could make out a strong case that instead of bringing this coal to make steel from Appalachia, in the worst environmental mining process in the world, strip mining, at greater cost in terms of emissions, because they're on diesel ships and diesel trains that transport the coal all the way across America and across the Atlantic. We could mine it here with no CO2 or reduced CO2 for sale to our steelworks to produce steel and have enough left over to send some of the coke to Europe, where they also import coal from America. And the council hall, this the Whitehaven is the 14th most socially and economically deprived area in Europe, right? 14th. There's been no green jobs that they're talking about. There never are any. There's no green jobs on the horizon. Your jobs are you can go up and work at Sellafield, you can work in the nuclear industry, or down out. And so the argument for the mine, which was going to employ 500 direct workers in the mine and 1,500 in ancillary, and also the company promised to upgrade the one and only line between Whitehaven and Cumbria and Carlisle, which is welcomed by everybody because that's the one where the passenger line as well. And so we managed to convince the county council. The Greens kicked up and kicked up a big storm and pulled all kinds of rabbits out of the hat. We eventually ended up having three inquiries during which they brought experts from all over the world, all these green scientists and environmentalists and all those people. And we presented our arguments. And on three occasions, the first twice unanimously, and then the last one, seven against, out of the whole council, approved the mine. So that was it. Now, Jenkins was the communities minister, and it was in his patch as to whether he called in that decision or not. And he decided not to, because we actually needed coal for to make steel. And if we were going to have any kind of expansion of wind turbines or anything else, we needed bloody steel for everything we do. In my view, unlawfully, the chairman of the Commons Climate Committee, which is an advisory body, made its mind up that it would like us to stop producing steel in Britain altogether. That's not a government policy. That's not a government plan, but it was their suggestion that we didn't produce steel in Britain anymore. We imported it. Now, I don't know how that saves the emissions, but it saves somebody's conscience. So the chairman then went to the chairman of the planning committee in Cumberland and told him, well, you know, the mine won't be needed because we'll not be producing steel. So you'll go allow all these people to be employed and then they'll all be sacked again. So the chairman of the planning committee off his own bat said, oh, well, we'd better reconsider it. At that point, the West Cumberland Mining, who'd been extremely patient over the last 4 years, said, right, we're taking you to court because we've now gone through all of the legal procedures and been cleared. This is not a part of the legal procedure. At that point, Jenrick called in the decision and set up an independent national inquiry, which would look at the technology, the science, the environment, and the social impact of opening the mine or not. And that report came out 2 years ago, but has been sat on for 2 years. They've given us four dates for when it would report back. We all of us knew that it was in our favour, because if it hadn't been, they'd have told us straight away. But they've been looking for dodges and loops and hoops that they could jump through to try and knock it back. All of the evidence has been gone through. Everything that the people from Greenpeace and the Green Party and Greta Thunberg and whoever else are saying now have all been looked at and considered, every dot, every comma, every cross, every T. Right? So the committee's approved, that inquiry has approved it. So now the government has no ways really not to approve it. So they've approved the mine. It's been a long, long fight. The company has promised the council 90% of all of the jobs at the pit will be filled locally. Now, obviously, there's not that many miners left fit and able in Cumberland. So it means that about 90%, 80% of the people at the pit will be new starters. So there's apprenticeships in mining, in engineering, in electronics, in surveying, in geology, etc., and in coal mining, which is a very skilled and noble profession. The rest of us old buggers who've applied will be probably doing the training or getting the developments started. Okay, so it's not the end yet, but it's certainly extremely good news. I could not be happier if I'd won the bloody lottery.
Now look, you're in an interesting position in Cumbria, in that you've also got Sellafield next door. And so it's a good place to weigh up. I mean, the arguments are that nuclear is more environmentally friendly, although I find that one a little bit difficult, especially since the waste is so toxic, dangerous, and lasts for tens of thousands of years, and you can't really do anything with it.
Well, first of all, Sellafield doesn't produce coke for steel, of course. Nuclear power stations can't make steel. So that's an entirely quite separate section. I mean, you can compare nuclear power to coal power in terms of supplying electricity, but you can't compare steel making to nuclear power. I mean, we need coal to make steel wherever we get it from.
No, well, that's a good point. But the argument is that the base load of the national power grid, what we need is some good, hefty power generating facilities around the country, and that nuclear will basically supersede coal.
Yeah, but you must keep these two arguments separate, because this is what the Greens do. They mix the two things up. Coal for steel production is irreplaceable. Nobody anywhere in the world makes steel for high tensile, high pressure, weight-bearing steel without coal. Nobody, right? There's an experimental plant in Sweden, which no doubt they'll tell you about, that are going to use make hydrogenized steel, oddly enough, using the process we developed at Hatfield, to make steel without coal that will go onto Volvo cars where price is no limit and the price of the steel is no limit. But you won't ever make a suspension bridge, an aeroplane, or a wind turbine out of that, right? So if you want steel, and we need steel, then we need coal. That's that argument. Now, in terms of energy, nuclear power theoretically provides a base load if it runs. But the trouble with it is it's infrequent. It has a million and one breakdowns. Of course, it's a very volatile fuel, as we know from the various disasters in Japan and in Ukraine that happened. And, while it doesn't radiate too many workers in the plant, when it does melt down, it does the whole bloody environment. And the other thing is, of course, you know, this is another argument, like steel, where does anybody think the uranium comes from? You need miners to mine uranium. It doesn't grow on trees. People have to mine it. It's not a renewable. It's a finite source. And because the world has jumped on the nuclear bandwagon as against coal, the demand for uranium is going up as the supply is going down. So now the amounts of uranium that have been, all the deep, big suppliers of uranium, like in Russia, places like that, have closed. So now you're scratching about looking for smaller and smaller deposits of uranium for your nuclear plant. But I've got no argument with nuclear plants. Nuclear will never, ever be the base load for energy in Britain. It can't be.
What about fracking? There's a lot of talk about that, isn't there?
Well, as a coal miner, I am not going to object to other people's methods of mining. Personally, my only objection to fracking, and again, you need to know something about mining to understand what they actually do. And the Greens produced all of these horror stories about the United States, about gas coming down people's taps and up their toilets and stuff like that, which was true, because the coal gas in America was like 100 yards under the surface. And it found its own way up. Once you fracked it, it found its own way through any nook and cranny up into the surface, which is a problem in the United States. It does it anyway, even if you don't frack it. Here we're talking about gas being taken from a mile and a mile and a half under the ground. It's never going to find its own way to the surface. So that was one of the arguments that were used against it. My only objection to fracking would be, don't do it in a coal field area. Don't do it in an area where we've already mined coal, almost to the depth of a mile in many cases, because then the fractures are already there. We already have fractured the strata through coal mining, and you don't want to start fracking underneath that, because then you can find a way to the surface for fracking.
Well, a lot of what you say makes sense. A lot of the policy doesn't make sense. It's over-reliance on wind power, where sometimes, you know, for days on end, there is none. What do you put it all down to, this battle over energy over the decades, including the fight with Arthur Scargill?
Exactly. I mean, that's why those things are tied together. You know, in the 70s and 80s, they said that the miners' strikes were political. Well, in a sense, because coal was the essential driving force right up until the end of the 80s, coal was always political. So the role of coal and the role of the coal industry and the role of the miners' union have been, you know, cornerstones for the last 200 years of industrial history in Britain. And the force of the working class that's most likely to cause problems to governments over the last 2 years have been the miners. So that's why as soon as ever they could get thought they could replace the miners by using anything else, wind turbines or solar panels or whatever, they would go and do that, regardless of its lack of efficiency. You know, so the primary aim for them was not energy utility, but solving a class question and a social question at home, which was defeating the miners' union and the power of the unions in general. So, you know, wind turbines, like I say, first of all, you can't make them without steel. The only work, and an argument I have to have with the Greens all the time is, wind turbines don't make wind. They don't produce wind. It's not like an oil well, you know. A wind turbine uses wind if there is wind. It's just the maths of trying to make wind energy meet even 2/3 of Britain's energy supply doesn't work.
Now, look, David, I know you've written about this. Can you just tell listeners about your books?
Well, that book you're referring to is called Coal, Climate Change, and the Total Destruction of the British Mining Industry in Britain. And it traces this whole final process really to the what I've just explained, really, the war against the miners and the decision to get rid of the mining industry in order to break the miners' union and to find some other means of supplying energy. You know, the reason why people have got bills that are 300%, 400% higher than they were previously is because, not because of the war in Ukraine, but because we're pursuing this ridiculous zero carbon policy to try and stop us producing coal, gas and oil. You know, one of the things that winds me up to distraction is that the Just Stop Oil people drive to the protests after filling their cars up with oil, safely park their car, and then sit down and stop everybody else's.
As someone that knows the industry very well, if you were in charge, what would you do now, bearing in mind you've got to look after the environment too?
Well, what I would do now is I would obviously endorse the decision to allow the Whitehaven mine to go ahead for steel production. I would also look at extending the life of the mine beyond the years it's been given. And I would scrap the net zero target automatically because it's a huge albatross around the neck of the economy. It's literally crippling us, and it will kill thousands of people through creating artificial shortages of energy, which we can do without. And we need to produce our own coal and our own steel and do our own manufacturing again. So that's the first thing I'd do is approve the mine, extend the life of that mine to allow it to open up greater reserves. There's plenty of reserves there. I would, as a temporary measure, allow a 5-year moratorium on two of the open cast mines, which they stopped producing in Durham and in Northumberland, to provide heritage coal for museums and for steam railways and all of that. Like, so the Flying Scotsman can actually use British coal to get up and down the country rather than importing inferior American coal, which doesn't allow it to actually fire the bloody engine up. So those are two immediate things. Long-term thing I would do is to reopen the Don Valley clean coal plant, get that back online, and set that up as an experimental model. And so we can start regenerating coal cleanly and using carbon capture and storage, and have that it'll take about 2 years to develop that, and have that as a test for a series of perhaps 6 of those power stations around Britain. We would need to minimally open about 20 new mines in Britain to supply us with steel, coal, and to supply us with enough energy coal for clean coal power stations. And we've got 4 of the mothballed power stations working at the moment to stop the lights going out. We should be using our own coal to staff that rather than importing it from Russia. We're still importing coal from Russia and from the United States.
Some will say there's an element of sabotage here. I'm not sure if I'm one of them, David, but the idea really seems to be to stop Britain being able to produce armaments, maybe even to stop us fighting a war, because one of the things that quite obviously happened is Britain is no longer has that spare energy capacity to do such things. And I wonder what you make of people who say, well, actually, Britain is basically being deliberately deindustrialized to make it a weak nation.
Yeah, I think that was Thatcher's plan, was to deliberately deindustrialize Britain, because she's seen, without being too overtly Marxist, that the proletariat, that's the industrial workers rather than just workers who flip burgers in McDonald's or drive taxis in London, that the proletariat, which produces the actual wealth, the nuts and bolts of wealth, industry, the smokestack industry, steel, coal, oil, transport, railway networks, all of these things, if you can get rid of the workers who produce those things, then you're never going to be threatened. And as far as possible, you export the production of those things abroad to countries where workers aren't as organized, don't have such strong unions. In any case, you won't have to suffer about them because some other country will do it. Now, that plan has more or less been fulfilled. That's exactly what they've done. So the Greens will tell you in their objection to the Whitehaven mine that they're not objecting to the steel production, which means they're not objecting actually to the emissions being created. What they're objecting to is us creating the emissions. They don't mind it being created in the United States or in Germany or in Russia or anywhere else, because they know that if we don't import the coal or mine the coal, we can't make steel. And if you can't make steel, as I've said infinitum, then you can't make wind turbines. You can't make solar panels. You can't make you can't make tidal wave barriers. You can't have any kind of renewable energy without coal. So, you know, yes, basically the idea was to open up a second front idea. So, you know, some American generals said, you know, we fought the First World War in Europe. We fought the Second World War in Europe. And if you suckers don't wake up, we'll be fighting the Third World War in Europe. All of which seems to have come to pass, really. And as far as Thatcher and her successors, the idea is if you can put the troublesome people, the coal miners, the steel workers, and all of them in some other country, and just have a service industry here where basically people can tip the forelock and live on tips, then they won't be threatened. And then the economy itself will be based on money speculation and multinational transactions around the world, which is, you know, essentially what's happened.
Well, and it's interesting that actually capitalism does seem to have completely failed. We've now got a system, a financial system, which is completely being propped up by printing money. I wonder if maybe Karl Marx is being proved right, that capitalism was going to actually maybe wrong, that he said it was going to be overthrown by a revolution. Maybe it's just going to collapse of its own accord.
Well, no, he covered that point as well. He basically said left alone, capitalism would fall apart. But I mean, he was right and he was wrong. He was right insofar as left to its own devices, capitalism would have ended 100 years ago. But what he didn't foresee was the development of imperialism, the ability to export exploitation abroad, seize other people's raw materials, exploit other workers abroad, and leave your home base, you know, pretty just ticking over. This is really, the Thatcher plan is basically just an extension of that idea, where you can sit pretty at home without the nasty proletariat hammering on your door, and you can allow China or India or Vietnam or other countries in the world to do the nitty-gritty of the work. And I must say the Greens have the same philosophy, basically.
Yeah, so what's going to happen with capitalism, do you think?
The trouble is not what's going to happen to capitalism, but what's going to replace it. And it's true capitalism can and will collapse, but the point wasn't really to collapse capitalism per se. The point was to replace it with something better. And there's something better is taking a little bit longer to go for. Because capitalism is in such a state of decay, it's actually burning its bridges as it goes. It's destroying the means of delivery behind it as it goes, which will leave us with nothing. And if we see the effects of imperialism in the Middle East, for example. You know, I mean, Gaddafi wasn't the worst guy in the Middle East, neither was Saddam. And compared to what you've got now in those countries, there were a lot of people would think they were a lot better. They were certainly a lot better off under these guys than they were under the fundamentalists and the jihadis and all of these gangs that they've got. So you get rid of, get rid of one form of oppressive thing and get something that's 10 times worse. And unfortunately, a catastrophic collapse of capitalism in the world without a socialist system to replace it could be actually worse than what we've got now.
Well, and what about this carbon trading system that King Charles seems to be so pro?
Well, it's the same thing, isn't it? You export your emissions abroad. It's like us gathering up all of the plastic we don't want and sending it to some poor third world country to actually set fire to it. The fact that we breathe the same air as they do doesn't seem to have dawned on these people. So we get it back in the end. We just don't see it happening. It's the same with producing these giant wind turbines in China, which is where most of them come from. And the emissions that go to make them and the number of workers who are killed in the steelworks making them, you just import it and put it in the offshore. And you think, I've got a lovely green Teletubby solution here with these nice whirling windmills, and there's nobody getting dirty and nobody's black and nobody's going down the pit. And it's a complete and utter bloody sham.
Just remind us of whereabouts people can get hold of your book again, please.
Well, I think that one's a victim of its own success. I think it's actually out of print now. But I have a nice little pamphlet, which is called Listen, Greens, which was my speech made at the Jarrah Rebel Town Festival last year, addressing this very question about coal, steel production, the environment, and what do we do about it. It only costs £5, which you can get from me if you email me. Send me your address and I'll send you it. And you can send me a check, because yes, we still use checks up north, or come to some other arrangement.
Okay, and so can you just give us your email address then,
and
please?
It's lowercase, which I've learned is a name for little letters, Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, David, one word, Douglas David, 705@gmail.com.
Well, David Douglas, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Very welcome. Next time you speak to me, I'll be coming out of the pit.